appropriate medical countermeasures, they can be distributed fairly, equitably, and efficiently, and that they will actually work.
We have to leave it there, Ed Yong. Thanks so much for being with us. Science writer at The Atlantic. We'll link to all of your articles. A little correction. Trump didn't go to Bedminster in New Jersey. He went to Trump National in Potomac Falls, Virginia, as the pandemic rages. And that ends today's show. A huge thanks to all of our team working at home and as well working here in the studio to make sure Democracy Now! Continues. And remember, show that you care by wearing a mask. Protect all. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
Listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Set up your lawn chairs, get the barbecue going, then tune in to KBOO on July 4th and 5th to listen and groove along with Blues Fest On Air. Blues Fest On Air will feature two full days of crowd favorite sets and behind-the-scenes stories from the Waterfront Blues Festival throughout the years. That's Saturday, July 4th and Sunday, July 5th from 12 p.m. to 7 p.m. right here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, in direct violation of a recent court order, Portland police fired tear gas at protesters and arrested three journalists last night. COVID-19 cases continue to rise in Oregon and across the United States. And in international news, over 300 protesters were arrested during a crackdown in Hong Kong after a new bill severely limiting the state's autonomy went into effect on Wednesday. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Last night, on the 34th consecutive night of protests in Portland, protesters gathered in Peninsula Park and marched to the Portland Police Association Union Building on North Lombard Street. They were calling for an end to police violence and racism, and many called for the dismantling of the police altogether to be replaced by community-based alternatives. The focus on the police union building came as the Portland City Council prepared to meet this morning to extend the police union contract for another year, which the City Council did with a unanimous vote this morning. In North Portland last night, outside the police union building, the protesters were met by dozens of police in riot gear who pushed them east towards Albina Avenue, where the police then assaulted the protesters with tear gas, concussion grenades, pepper spray, and rubber-coated steel bullets. Eyewitnesses and video feeds from the protest show the protesters complying with the police order to move east across the I-5 overpass on Lombard. In videos of the protest, people are seen coming out of their homes to support the protest, while drivers alongside the route also honk their support. Police fired CS gas at least once into the crowd and neighborhood, as well as into a TriMet bus with passengers inside. This is despite a court order banning them from using CS gas on protesters. Lawyers for the group that filed the lawsuit, Don't Shoot Portland, filed papers with the court on Tuesday, calling on the judge to sanction city officials for allowing the continued use of tear gas despite the court order. During Tuesday night's protests, two KBOO volunteers were arrested while filming the demonstration on live video feeds. In addition, a Portland-based documentary filmmaker was arrested while filming. Eyewitnesses say police were clearly targeting those people with press credentials who were filming the protests. Following the tear gas, pepper spray, and beating of protesters by Portland police, several protesters set a dumpster on fire and pushed it into the road between protesters and police. No other property destruction or vandalism was seen in the area of the protests. In addition to targeting journalists, police were also filmed violently taking down an older white man and repeatedly spraying him with pepper spray directly in the face while kneeling on his back and neck. This morning, the Portland City Council voted unanimously to extend the contract with the Portland Police Association for 1 year. The Portland Police Association, or PPA, is the union that represents police officers in Portland. Labor leaders in the city of Portland have condemned the PPA, saying that it is in fact not a union, but a way for police to avoid accountability for their actions. Negotiations for a new contract will begin in January of 2021. Here are some excerpts from the public testimony given at this morning's video conference city council meeting.
First of all, my name is Hyung Nam. I'm representing Portland Metro People's Coalition. I'm a public school teacher with PPS and a union member. And also I've served as a official budget advisory committee member for the Portland Police Bureau recently. And I just want to say, first of all, I want to underscore the contract letter that many of our organizations signed on to, calling for some very specific changes to the police contract. And that is especially with dealing with racism and lack of accountability around use of force. And I just want to also underscore that, you know, while the content of the contract is extremely important, there are a lot of other things outside the contract that I would like, especially Mayor Wheeler as Commissioner of Police, to do. We've been seeing nightly brutality against protesters. Last night was one of the worst cases that we've seen. And if you pay attention to those sequences of how things happen, you will see that it is the police that incite violence, that incite protesters nightly. And they are violating the rights of not only the protesters, but of the public, of journalists and medics, attacking them with CS gas, even though it's supposed to be banned. This is going into people's homes, into people that are just driving by, into their cars. This could cause traffic accidents. It could cause major health problems during this pandemic. This is a threat to public safety. We're wasting taxpayer dollars with these police officers that are threatening police safety. And I know that there ACLU recently pointed out issues with the Directive 635.10 on crowd management and crowd control. This has also been pointed out by the auditor after the June 4th, 2017 protests, where we've seen some huge problems when they kettled 400 people in a whole block, including including journalists, took photos of their ID, and there were all kinds of recommendations made there by the IPR and the audit.
That's 3 minutes.
I wanted to ask why the Portland Police Union contract is being extended for a year when they've been on the record saying that if it were allowed to expire, it would go into a status quo period where a new contract could be adopted at any time. So I'm wondering why not start the public engagement process immediately on a new contract and have it adopted immediately rather than waiting a whole year to start that process?
Yeah, John, that's a fair question, and it's one that we actually considered, and I'll give my best answer, and then maybe Kathy or Heidi or one of my colleagues have a different response. I actually was concerned that January was too late. When we started this process, I thought, wow, we're going to push this all the way to January. That seems like a long time to delay. But now that I've seen how the COVID crisis is unfolding, I'm actually concerned that January may be too soon. The bottom line is we want to get going as quickly as we can to have the full community engagement process that we pledged right up front when we started this process and we held our community listening sessions. One of the top values that was almost universally agreed to was more public participation in the process. And we just cannot do it under COVID with the restrictions that we have.
I'm Dan Handelman with Portland Cop Watch. Cop Watch understands that circumstances surrounding the pandemic have led to the now hasty renewal of the PPA collective bargaining contract. In general, we also understand that meeting the community's demands to defund and rethink the purpose of police in society has added an extra layer of complexity to the negotiating process. In that sense, the one-year renewal you are considering today buys some time to reimagine what can be done to minimize community harm while protecting the rights of officers to earnings and benefits. Clearly, the opportunity to expand the Portland street responses as an alternative to police responding to houseless persons and mental health crises is one step toward reducing our city's overdependence on police. However, this agreement also signals the possibility that Mayor Wheeler will never have to go through the hard, tough negotiations to remove the barriers to accountability baked into the contract. After winning the May primary in 2016, the mayor cheered that on then-Mayor Charlie Hales from the sidelines as Hales negotiated a contract which nominally removed the 48-hour rule but left the other barriers in place. The adoption of that contract was done with council meeting in the Rose Room while Joanne Hardesty and I were among those locked in city council chambers. If Mayor Wheeler is not reelected, his opponent will be negotiating the 2021 contract. Copwatch has been among the community groups demanding that the contract be changed to allow IPR to investigate deadly force cases, which is currently prohibited. That agency also needs to be able to compel officers to testify and not be required to interview officers in police facilities, which are issues limited by the current contract. The community letter we signed also called for drug testing of officers after deadly force incidents, which is not allowed now. This delay means we have to live for another full year with all of these limitations in place, among others. Some changes have to be made in the contract, some to state law, and some to city law. For example, the community demand for the city to fire officers more easily needs to be addressed. The bill which just passed in the legislature was incorrectly characterized by Governor Brown over the weekend as limiting arbitrators' ability to overturn discipline of officers. The bill only applies to situations where arbitrators agree that misconduct occurred, though it does limit their ability to lower the amount of proposed discipline. Further steps must be taken to limit the arbitrator's ability when considering whether misconduct occurs in serious cases. It also means various side agreements to the contract, including provisions of the discipline matrix, are also on hold for a year. Even PPA President Daryl Turner admitted the matrix needs to be revisited in the context of the sergeant whose maximum punishment for making an openly racist remark at roll call was 3 weeks off without pay. In terms of the transparency, which has been unprecedented until today's agreement was announced, it's clear negotiations took place to put this contract together. The last known negotiating session held at PPA headquarters March 13 was reportedly used to finalize ground rules. Those rules include that every other meeting be held in public. The contract was signed on June 8, about 2 weeks into the uprisings after the murder of George Floyd. While city officials hinted they were thinking about extending the contract in various public forums, nobody was told about the sessions held to create this tentative agreement. We hope the extra time will be used to facilitate more and deeper community dialogues about changes needed to next year's contract. We appreciate that council is making some efforts to meet community demands on holding police accountable, but we also remember the slogan that justice delayed is justice denied, and we sent you a longer version of that testimony by email yesterday.
Thank you, Dan. Always appreciate it.
Those were excerpts from this morning's Portland City Council meeting on the issue of extending the Portland Police Association union contract for an additional year. The council voted unanimously to extend the union contract for a year until June of 2021. Oregon is among many states seeing coronavirus cases jump after taking steps to reopen the economy. Starting today, the state requires Oregonians in all counties to wear masks in indoor public spaces. That includes grocery stores and restaurants while not eating or drinking. Yesterday, Governor Kate Brown extended the state of emergency through September 4th, which allows her previous executive orders to remain in place. Oregon lawmakers also extended the current eviction moratorium through September. Today, Oregon Health Authority reported 281 new cases of COVID-19 and 3 new deaths. 192 people remain hospitalized for COVID-19, including 24 people who are on ventilators. So far, 195 people have died of the coronavirus in Oregon, and the total number of infections is nearing 9,000. A majority of recent infections are in the Portland metro area, while cases are rising in some rural counties like Umatilla and Union. A report from the Oregon Health Authority that came out Friday predicts the state will see a dramatic surge in cases in the coming weeks. The report says Oregon's daily infection rate could reach between 900 and 5,000 infections per day. Early this morning, around 100 Seattle police, dressed in mostly riot gear, marched into the Capitol Hill organized protest, known as CHOP, arresting at least 32 people. Last night, Mayor Jenny Durkan issued an emergency executive order for protesters to vacate the area and declared the protest, which had started June 8th, quote, an unlawful assembly. Police said the action on Wednesday was designed to protect the public, citing some recent shootings there, including two deaths, as well as theft, assaults, and property crimes. Those occupying CHOP have said the shootings were not connected with the zone and are no different from what the neighborhood might see under normal circumstances. Police formed ranks and used their bicycles as makeshift fences, while wielding batons and rifles as occupants responded with chants and calls to leave them alone. Seattle Black Collective Voice, which formed in CHOP, reiterated their ongoing demands to defund the police, use that money to invest in community health and services, and dropped criminal charges against protesters. The public art created at CHOP, including a large, colorful mural across its main street that says Black Lives Matter, is expected to be preserved. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast. We'll be speaking with a member of Sunrise Beaverton about their upcoming open mic event to allow the community to vent their frustrations that the city council may not be willing to hear. At 7, stick around. We're hearing Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with a low of 54. Tomorrow's weather, expect partly cloudy skies and a high of 75 degrees. Today in history, in 1922, Toshi Seeger was born. Seeger was a filmmaker and environmental activist who, with her husband, Pete Seeger, co-founded the Great Hudson River Revival, a festival that attracts 15,000 music lovers every year. Under her direction, the festival implemented many policies unheard of at the time, including using sign language interpreters, recycling, and wheelchair accessibility. She used the opportunity to rally public support for cleaning up the Hudson River. The quote of the day is from Stephen Gaskin, an activist who, in 1971, co-founded the intentional community known as The Farm. Quote, "You have to be true to yourself, but you have to be true to your best self, not the self that secretly thinks you are better than other people." Nearly 400 protesters were arrested in Hong Kong as a new national security law took effect today, on the 23rd anniversary of Hong Kong's handover from Britain to China. The sweeping law, drafted almost entirely in secret, strips Hong Kong of its autonomy and cements Beijing's control over the city and its residents. The new law says that the right to trial by a jury can be suspended, trials can be heard in secret, and the maximum sentence for criminality is life in prison. One person arrested on Wednesday was a 15-year-old girl waving a Hong Kong independence flag, which is now against the law, along with any other signs that promote Hong Kong's independence. The new law gives authorities powers to crack down on dissent and grants China new levels of control over the semi-autonomous territory, as well as allowing those accused of certain crimes to be tried in mainland China. While police fired tear gas, pepper spray, and water cannons at the thousands of people demonstrating, Hong Kong's chief executive, Carrie Lam, and government dignitaries from the city and Beijing drank champagne in celebration. The Multnomah County Library System just eliminated late fees, including the $730,000 currently owed by more than 72,000 patrons. It has also restored library checkout privileges to more than 2,000 people whose accounts were blocked because of unpaid fines. Abandoning library late fines is a national trend based on data that fines do not improve return rates and discourage people who would most benefit from using library services from ending up there. Checkout items will now be automatically renewed until another person places a hold on it. If the patron doesn't return the item 49 days after a hold is placed, they will be billed for the replacement cost. The Multnomah County Library System collected about $550,000 in overdue fines in the fiscal year 2019, less than 1% of its annual budget. On Tuesday, Mayor Ted Wheeler, along with City Commissioners Chloe Udaly, Amanda Fritz, and Joanne Hardesty, co-sponsored a resolution meant to strengthen the city's approach to combating climate change. The move intends to create more racial and social equity in the city. The resolution declares that the city will seek to support and advance climate initiatives led by Black and Indigenous groups, as well as pursue partnerships with youth in the city. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael is ready to confront summer.
The fire is surging. We're in heat. Summer's here, and we shall be free, entertained, and invulnerable. Will I ever go to the gym again? Eat inside a restaurant? Buffets gone forever? No birthday candles on cakes to blow out? More deliveries in their containers? More plastic? More antibacterial in the water system? More suspicion of anyone coughing, barefaced, or too close? We'll forget how to hug, how to read faces, what people smell like, voices not through a device. Oh, brave new world, dancing between invisible vectors, asymptomatic but still contagious, culling the herd, taking one piece too many from the Jenga of capitalism. Meanwhile, Siberia's burning, oceans rising as well as population, locusts, hurricanes, drought coming up soon, so many unwanted choices, so fewer safe havens, one atmosphere, one planet, now or never. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
The U.S. has 4% of the world's population and 25% of the world's reported COVID-19 cases. Yesterday, the U.S. recorded more than 44,000 coronavirus cases, a new one-day record, while 8 states, including California, Arizona, and Texas, also reported single-day highs. Testifying before the Senate yesterday, Dr. Anthony Fauci said of the virus, quote, "I would not be surprised if we go up 100,000 a day if this does not turn around." He also remarked, quote, "Clearly, we're not in total control." The COVID Tracking Project said the U.S.'s 7-day average for newly daily cases has doubled since June 30th, and hospitalizations jumped by the highest number since April 21st. Because of the surge in cases here, the European Union confirmed yesterday it would bar Americans from non-essential travel to its countries. The Navajo community in Eugene, Oregon, recently hosted an Indigenous solidarity event with the Black community. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native people and their allies recently gathered in Eugene, Oregon, for an Indigenous solidarity event with the Black community. KLCC's Brian Bull has more.
Speakers, music, and a teepee mark the gathering. Jane Coverdale is a Tlingit native from Alaska. She says for some, this event is more inclusive than others over the past month.
I have heard women and non-binary Indigenous people speak about how they didn't feel safe at certain organizations because of the misogyny. So this is a space where those people can feel safe to show their support.
Jacob Billy is a Yakima Indian. He says dialogue is a crucial step towards ending divisions along lines of class, race, and privilege.
Some people are more equal than others in this nation. So how do we deal with them? I think when we talk them out, we can work out differences that will be beneficial to all of us.
Both Billy and Coverdale say this isn't to detract from the broader message of justice reform and empowerment, just that more work needs to happen to make the U.S. a truly inclusive nation. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Eugene, Oregon.
The Greater Cincinnati Native American Coalition is calling for an end to Indian mascots at Ohio schools. The group's renewed calls come as a virtual school board meeting Tuesday discussed changing a Cincinnati high school's mascot. The coalition sent a statement to the Forest Hills School Board regarding Anderson School's R-word mascot. Jennifer Knickerbocker is a member of the Native Coalition.
The Greater Cincinnati Native American Coalition Board of Directors sent a statement to the school district supporting the removal of the racist mascot due to its racially insensitive and stereotype-promoting nature that is incongruent with a public institution's obligation to support the civil rights of all students. GCNAC also supports the Anderson High School student group, who have organized a petition to change the Arskin mascot.
The coalition has long called for an end to Indian mascot use at schools, including at Anderson High School. Members of the coalition have written letters, attended school board meetings, made phone calls, and initiated campaigns. The coalition is urging for the removal of the R-word mascot, especially during a time of unrest seen across the United States. During the more than 1 hour and a half meeting, statements for and against changing the mascot were read. There was no vote by the Forest Hills School District during the special meeting. The school board will continue to examine the mascot issue. The Navajo Nation has extended its state of emergency order and the closure of its government through July 26th due to COVID-19. 57-hour weekend lockdowns are also extended through July 20th. During a virtual town hall Tuesday, Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez said the emergency orders, including curfews, requiring face coverings, and other precautions, are working. He pointed to data showing a steady flattening of the curve.
Don't let up. Don't back down from this virus. Don't just think, oh, okay, we're going down now. I don't have to wear a mask. I don't have to wash. You know, you got to continue to do those things. Social distancing. Even our relatives that are off the Navajo Nation, tell them to do the same thing. They don't have to be forced to do it. You as mom and dad, grandma, grandpa, Nelly should be able to say, hey, do that. Off the nation.
Closures of Navajo casinos are also being extended through July. As of Tuesday, the number of COVID-19 positive cases for the Navajo Nation was more than 7,500. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A Black Lives Matter group in Des Moines continues to put pressure on Iowa's governor, who is known to be a mouthpiece of the president. The group is demanding the governor sign an executive order meant to restore voting rights for people with past felony convictions. Mike Moen of the Public News Service has more on the story.
The group Black Lives Matter says it won't stop pressing Iowa's governor to sign an executive order restoring voting rights for people with past felony convictions. Nearly 2 weeks after saying she would take action, some worry the governor is reconsidering. Black Lives Matter Des Moines has been trying to hold demonstration at Governor Kim Reynolds' daily appearances in hopes of getting her attention. They want her to follow up on a verbal commitment to restore the voting rights of those with past felony convictions. BLM organizer Jalen Cavill says Reynolds needs to act soon with the November election on the horizon.
You know, we're not going to have enough time for these folks who have been disenfranchised, for some folks for decades, to get them registered to vote, re-engaged in the process.
Iowa's the only state left in the country to impose a lifetime ban on voting for people with felony convictions, only allowing individual appeals to the governor's office. The law affects nearly 60,000 Iowans, including nearly 1 in 10 African-American adults. Reynolds' office did not reply to a request for comment before deadline. Cavill says they're also concerned that the longer it takes, the chances become greater that Reynolds will sign a watered-down order.
We don't want there to be anything that says, oh, folks need to pay a restitution. We're also concerned that she's going to have some sort of exceptions in there, like, per se, people who committed violent crimes.
Reynolds has previously pushed state lawmakers to amend the Iowa Constitution to restore voting rights for felons, but Senate Republicans have thwarted the efforts. The governor did support a plan in the legislature that would have set conditions, but it didn't get final approval from lawmakers before the recent session ended. Mike Moen, Public News Service. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Jenka Soderberg, and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's KBOO Talk Radio. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Teresa Mitchell. At 9:30, catch Fight the Empire, connecting history with current events. At 10, we'll hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. Then at 11, it's Between the Covers, featuring interviews with authors from around the country. And at 11:30, it's Black Book Talk. Tomorrow, we have an interview from 2015 with Oregon Black Pioneers board member Kimberly Moreland discussing the history of black people in Portland and Oregon. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. And if you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. Protests for racial justice and police reform call on local governments to be on the forefront of change. The protests and their demands have persisted for over a month now. Some city governments are taking the demands more seriously than others. In Beaverton, local activists find their city's response frustrating and have decided to do something about it. The Sunrise Movement is most commonly known for its involvement in the fight for climate justice and that it involves a lot of young organizers. The Sunrise Hub in Beaverton is organizing an open mic on Thursday, July 2nd to give the community an opportunity to voice their concerns around racial justice and changes to the police force that are not being heard elsewhere. I spoke with one of Sunrise Beaverton's organizers, Pedro, to learn more. Can you tell me a little bit about Sunrise Beaverton and how you got involved?
Yeah, so I've been living in Beaverton now for 5 years, and last year I came across some people striking in front of City Hall. It was a climate strike, and I like rolled up because, I don't know, living here in Beaverton, but like working in Portland and having friends and community in Portland, I just was kind of wrapped up with the scene over there and kind of thought of Beaverton as this like sleepy suburban area outside of Portland. So it was really exciting for me to see some action, especially concerning climate here in Beaverton. So I got in touch with one of the hub coordinators at this climate strike, and I've been involved ever since.
And so I understand Sunrise Beaverton is holding a community open mic regarding police accountability on Thursday. What's the motivation for setting that up?
Well, a couple of things. We felt like, especially this like quarantine season, I would say that there's been a really like slow public response by the city government on a lot of issues. In the past, in the beginning of like quarantine, we've hosted this conversation called the Beaverton Here and Now. And we had some community organizations talking about their response to the pandemic and how their work's been affected. And there were some grassroots organizations that were there, and a lot of like really encouraging stuff happening here within the community. And yeah, like I said, the public response has been really or the city government's response here has been really slow and lacking in our opinion. So the Beaverton open mic conversation came about with this little like back and forth with the city government. We called in support of Lacey Beatty's A Can't Wait proposal and talked about that being the first step in needing to move on to conversations around the police budget. The police here get $36.7 million out of our general fund, and we feel like if we reinvested some of that money into our communities, that we could provide care for each other here that does not include like armed police officers. So after that, there was some conversation with city officials who spoke on at an event that happened at the Beaverton Library on Juneteenth. And it was really, really lackluster from both the mayor, Denny Doyle, and one of our city council members, Kate Arnold. And when we approached the mayor later about our concerns with It Can't Wait not passing, he asked us to just speak more about it at the city council meeting that next Tuesday. Turns out there was no public comment on City Council that next Tuesday. So a couple of us got together with Sunrise and some other community organizers to pressure City Council to open up public comments. We finally did get them to add public comment to the agenda. And again, another outpouring of the community spoke specifically around like SROs in our schools, defunding the police, and you know, all of these issues. And there was even people there talking about the need for a disability advisory board. And then to our disappointment, the mayor and the council president just jumped into the consent agenda without any recognition of any of the comments that were made. Our city officials are really hard to get in contact with. Lacey mm-hmm. Beatty's been the only one that responds to any messages or responds with the intention of hearing us out, even if there is distance between where we stand and where she stands. Our city council has been very dismissive of claims of you know, systemic issues here, and they don't have their contact information publicly available. They don't have social media pages that we could reach out. So yeah, we're trying to like elevate the community's voice in a way that is like confrontational to our city officials, because they do seem to just be hiding. The mayor specifically said that we can't keep hiding on this issue anymore, and that this issue is like a freight train, which kind of shows like where they are on these systemic issues, to describe it as a freight train and not like the community mourning for our brothers and sisters throughout the country. And here, like especially with like ICE activity in Hillsboro, and just the systemic issues that are very real here in Beaverton. So we just feel like we need to provide a platform for the community to speak on not just police accountability, but imagining possible futures with more accountability and more justice. The city council is not meeting this week, so when we like mulled that over within Sunrise, we just thought that there's a lot of untapped comments here within the city, within the community members, and we just wanted to provide a platform for people to speak up around all of these issues.
A quick footnote here, Pedro mentioned the 8 Can't Wait campaign. 8 Can't Wait is a project of Campaign Zero, a group which advocates for the end of police brutality in America. It sprung up out of the first wave of Black Lives Matter protests in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014. 8 Can't Wait refers to 8 police reform measures that have the potential to drastically reduce police violence. Around the country, towns and cities have adopted these reforms, though many advocates for racial justice in policing stress that it's only the beginning. The 8 reforms include banning chokeholds and strangleholds, requiring police to attempt to de-escalate a situation before resorting to violence, and requiring police to give a warning before shooting someone. The reforms would also make sure that police exhaust all their options for dealing with a situation before using their gun. Another critical reform would give cops a duty to intervene, meaning if a fellow cop is using excessive force, their colleagues must step in and report it. The measures would ban cops from shooting at moving vehicles and create a use of force continuum. That means there would be stricter rules about what kind of force police officers can use in response to different levels of resistance. 8 Can't Wait also asks for a comprehensive reporting requirement, so cops have to report every time they use force or threaten to use it against a civilian. That's 8 Can't Wait. Let's jump back in. Could you speak to 8 Can't Wait a little bit?
Yeah, well, one of our council members proposed 8 Can't Wait, and we understand that 8 Can't Wait is like a necessary first step, but also a baby step in the fight for racial justice, and we wanted to like get 8 Can't Wait passed and out of the way so we can start talking about bigger issues with policing and racial justice in this community. And as common sense as 8 Can't Wait is, it still has not passed our city government, and there was a lot of back and forth about like the use of force and why cops need to be able to shoot at moving vehicles and things of that nature. So really, like, It Can't Wait's only a first step, but when we talk about community care and how, I guess, I'm thinking back to like a conversation I had with Kate Arnold at the Juneteenth event and asking her about defunding the police and how year after year that I've lived here, the Beaverton School District has been asked to go through budget cuts. And we have those conversations like as if they're necessary things and something that has to happen, but we never bring that same energy to the police departments. And what we understand now with the COVID pandemic is that this isn't just like an issue concerning health, but this will soon become an issue concerning our economy. And what I'm really worried about is that we're going to ask, again, all of our public services to go through budget cuts again, but we still are not looking at the police budgets.
I know lots of folks who are familiar with the Sunrise Movement might know Sunrise to be most focused on climate justice. What is that connection between climate justice and police accountability? Or put another way, why is Sunrise involved?
Yeah, I'm really glad you answered that. Personally, I've been like climate aware from a very, very young age. And I'm so happy that the climate movement, especially with Sunrise and groups like Extinction Rebellion, that we've evolved from single issues that we involved from these individual issues like saving the polar bears and saving monarch butterflies, but we have a more vast scope on what justice actually looks like. We understand that we cannot fight for climate justice without also fighting for racial justice, because it's people of color and communities of the global south that are on the front lines of climate chaos. And yeah, I'm just really glad that the scope has enlarged on those issues. When I was first involved with like policy stuff and stuff with like NGOs around climate, it really was around those individual issues, and it just was so frustrating to try to be a part of, because I remember like it was November of 2016, we were building up to the election, Trump had gotten elected, and we were trying to like organize people around invasive species of grass. And being like a first generation American, and like my uncle got deported later that year, it was just so hard to like live with that in my identity, and also being so concerned around climate and not seeing the sense of urgency within this organization, specifically concerning those like individual issues. And we need to have like this broader analysis of justice at the center of what we do, so that as we build the future that we want, we do not replicate the harms in our current society and are instead a part of the process of healing that comes with this type of work.
Right. The issues are not mutually exclusive.
Exactly.
So if listeners are interested in participating in the open mic or listening to the Beaverton community on these issues, what's the best way for them to do that?
Okay, so I would highly encourage people to speak out and have their voices heard on this platform. We have a bit.ly, so that's bit.ly/Beaverton Open Mic, and that'll send you to the form, the participation form. There's also a YouTube link in that forum for people to watch, like, I guess, a little promo video that we pulled together for this. And we are going to be live streaming the conversation on our Facebook page, which is Sunrise Beaverton. So I would highly encourage people to check out that bit.ly link. One more time, that's bit.ly/Beaverton Open Mic, or check us out on Facebook.
Pedro, do you have any closing thoughts before we wrap up?
Here in Beaverton, we find that sometimes the media coverage is lacking. So I want to like thank you for covering this issue. Sometimes we feel like it's lacking because we're so close to Portland or whatever's going on in the city legislature, or sorry, the state, and with the house there. But whenever I'm in the community, either at the farmer's market, the grocery store, or on the max, people are so willing to engage on these crucial topics, whether it's ADA issues or climate justice or racial justice. And I feel like there's so much untapped potential here within our community. And part of that has to do with the media coverage too. So yeah, thank you for covering this event. And I really hope that this drives some of the engagement with our event tomorrow.
That was Pedro with the Sunrise Movement in Beaverton, talking about the connection between climate justice, racial justice, and police accountability. Sunrise Beaverton will be hosting an open mic on Thursday, July 2nd. More information on the open mic is available at bit.ly/BeavertonOpenMic. The event will be live streamed on the group's Facebook page. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
We are joined now by Kate Titus with Common Cause to talk about a ballot measure that's being proposed for the November election. And this is a ballot measure about redistricting and about gerrymandering of districts in Oregon. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what this measure is and what it will do if it passes.
Yeah, thanks for covering this story. I think it's really important. So, well, first, it's most basic. I think most people have a basic understanding of redistricting, but it's not something we think about as much as we probably should, given that it really gets at the heart of political power. So just to give context, I think most of us recall that every 10 years, the country conducts a census to get an updated count of the U.S. population. That's happening right now. Then once that's done, we redraw the maps for political districts, adjusting for shifts in the population so that there's an equal number of people in each district, giving every vote the same weight. So the way we shape those districts really has a big impact on who can get voted, what blocks of voters and what voter interests really can aggregate to have power. And it can be used really as a way for one party to